Hello, welcome back to Millennial 2018, and I'm now here with Morgoth from Morgoth's Review. Quite a lot of you know him, and he's been on several times before. He's one of the most frequently requested guests for Millennial, and all I need to say now is that Morgoth, welcome to Millennial 2018.
Hello again, thanks for asking us on. All right, lads there in the chat. I've asked the regulars from Morgoth's Review to pop in and back us up in the chat there. So I should have my boys there.
Great, great. Well, for those who aren't familiar with you, do you want to briefly introduce yourself and how you, how you got to where you are now with a YouTube channel and so on?
Well, I started out with a... You were back in the day, if you want to go right back into it, with the Telegraph, when you the Telegraph blogs.
Yeah.
That's how I ended up with being lumbered with Morgoth, because it was I had a whenever I got banned, I would come back with a Tolkien themed character, and I ended up being sick of being banned and opened the blog when I was on when I was posting under Morgoth. And it's shit now because Neo Reaction is coming way back and I'm constantly being hammered for naming myself after Satan. If I could have me time over, I'd call myself Tom Fisher. But I'm stuck with it now.
Well, I mean, maybe we can pretend. I'll start calling you Tom or Mr. Fisher. I'm okay, welcome to Millennial 20. I'm here with Tom Fisher, who you all know.
I got sick of being banned, and then I opened my own blog. I was constantly being told by like bloggers at the Telegraph and Breitbart, if you don't like it, just open your own blog and you can say whatever you want. So I did. And then the last few months I've been doing more on YouTube, really. And that was like a time thing, because it's actually really hard work to write full-blown articles with the typos and everything like that. So I started doing YouTube, which I could do sort of off the cuff when I'd come in from work in the middle of the week, and it's kind of easier like that. The problem is, like, YouTube as a community is like sort of full of drama queens and twats. And then when you're a blogger, you tend to get left alone with your readership. But I'm settling in there.
Right. All right. So I've just seen that Red Ice have got a second strike on their channel. Sorry, I didn't know. They can't upload for 2 weeks or something. I don't know how long this will be. God, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely fucking ridiculous. Okay. So, all right. So you've got the YouTube channel now, and that's really sort of taken off. And when did he start the YouTube channel? Was that a year ago or was it this year?
It was a year ago, but I didn't really do anything with it. Cause I'm shit with technology, and Thebiton, who's got a great little channel, we'll probably get into some of that stuff a bit later on. I posted a few bits and bobs on there, and I had a few hangouts, but I didn't really do much with it, and I just kept on blogging. And then I just thought I'd make a go of it. I went down and saw Thebiton and Sussex Damsel, and we saw, yeah, let's make a real push of it on the YouTube channel. It should be just for a bit of a change, because I've been blogging for like 4 years. And, yeah, that's how it's kind of came about.
Right.
I mean, I'm still finding my feet with it, but it's interesting.
Yeah, and you do seem to have taken to it, because I remember I encouraged you to go for it, and you weren't sure, but it and you weren't comfortable with it at first, but it does seem like you're far more comfortable with it now.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, it's because I work full time, and this, what I do, is really just a part time thing. I mean, it's nice now because I get a few donations and I don't have to do overtime anymore. And once or twice, I've even just not gone in because I thought, well, I'll take a day off and you don't have to pay us. But it doesn't matter because I've got donations for that now. So, like, I did a one on the snowman a week or two back, which I was quite proud of, and that was mainly because I just fucked work off and sat at home working on that and sending messages to Thebiton about how we should go about it and stuff, and it went down really well, and it was
quite a big production for you, wasn't it, the snowman video, which I haven't watched yet, because I'm keeping it, I'm saving it from as a treat for when Millennial's over. But do you want to talk about that now, or do you want to get towards that?
Well, the idea of it was, I thought we're heading towards Christmas, and people in our movement are just bombarded with horror and gore, like, day in, day out. I mean, even if you've just, if you all you've got's a Twitter account and you're kind of sharing memes and things on Twitter, you'll notice that it is just an endless sort of plethora of rapes and horror statistics and like sort of sexual degeneracy and skullduggery by the globalist elite. And it can be just overwhelming, and I can understand. But I mean, one of the things I've had to deal with in offline in the real world is people being traumatized by this stuff and trying to find a way to sort of get them through it. A young lad that I work with in particular, but maybe I'll get onto that later. And I wanted to make something which just have a little video up where it was just a positive depiction of English identity, but it's really Northern European. But in this case of the snowman, it's specifically very English. And I wanted to sort of combine that with some of these things on Heidegger and the more philosophical things that I've been looking into this year, and kind of delve into the what makes something cozy and what makes something nice. And it was really interesting to get into, because one of the things I took away from that, doing that video and thinking about it and discussing it with Everton, was that the identity is in place, that sort of cozy feeling of authenticity was in place when all of the contingent pieces were in place, when all of the right pieces were in place. Then you actually found some sort of being, some sort of healthy way of existing in the world, which the sort of the snowman, that's it, because everybody loves it.
And it was such a part of my childhood. Now, I should say, actually, because for people who might not know, The Snowman is an animated film. Not really, a cartoon isn't right. I mean, it is a cartoon, but it doesn't look like any other cartoon. It's of a very nice style and aesthetic that I don't know what the word would be for it, but it's a beautifully made film from, I think it was made in 1982, and it was shown on Channel 4, which had just started that year, I believe, and it was like their Christmas thing. And it's a lovely story. It's a children's thing, and it was there throughout my childhood. I mean, everyone had seen it, maybe watched it every year or two. It was a constant presence throughout my childhood, and many, I think even now, it's still regarded as a classic. Probably even children today, they all know it, I imagine. Because there was a sequel made just a couple of years ago, The Snow Dog, if I recall correctly. So this is what it is, and it is about a wee boy in England, somewhere in England. There are no words, there's no dialogue, and I don't think there are even sound effects. I think it's all just musical. I think there is one sound effect of the motorbike engine starting. I think that's the only one. And it's just a very beautiful, poetic story, like beautifully done. He builds a snowman, this wee boy, and then the snowman comes to life, and they sort of have an adventure together. And it's all very rural, very innocent, and just an incredibly well done, touching film. So, okay, with that said, Morgoth, go back to what you were saying.
Well, so I was trying to, in today, what I get into in the video is that in today's, the way we live today, everything has to be sort of quantified and laid out with spreadsheets and data. And so how can you explain that sort of the loveliness of the snowman through that sort of post-Enlightenment British empiricist way of looking at the world, where it's just pure rational and science, and it can't be done? But then when you start, and I know there's you could name like Bach or Wagner and go really epic with this kind of thing, but just to focus in on a simple little cartoon, Even when you just sort of take that apart and look into what makes it so lovely, you come back again and again, and it's all markers of identity and belonging in the world. And what's interesting is that, I mean, lefties and liberals will love the snowman, and they're still sort of harking back to a more pure form of life and a different way of looking at the world. It's just they don't know it. But they'd hate the idea of what I'm saying now. But that is where it comes down to and what makes it cozy. And it gets into this sort of Heideggerian thing of where we live today. I think Truel Dilton said it very well, where it was like a sort of technocratic consumer grid across the world, where everything is just rational. It isn't, but they say it's rational and scientific and all the rest of it. And he put it on the stream that you had with him very well, where you're only seeing the upper part of the hand, but you don't see the under part of the hand. And I think when you try to do this revealing, then you can try and take a look at what's not being addressed. What is it, the emotions and the feelings and the senses of belonging, which you can't actually pin down through spreadsheets and data and all of the rest of it. And that's basically what I got into with the Snowman cartoon. The sad thing is this, it's the snowman melts at the end, of course, and that was a difficult bit to get around. And it, the message from Ray Briggs was that at the end of the day, you're going to have to grow up and these things will end. And I left a sort of question hanging in the air where, is it possible to sort of return to this way of being, or are we forever trapped in this hyper-materialistic shit dump of the modern world? But I left it hanging there, and then I was planning to sort of just
Before we get to that, what is it that, because you say that we now have this very empiricist, cold, scientific view of things, and that's how anything is justified or defended. That's the only way we have to justify or defend anything now. So what is it that we're missing? When you say I know what Truel Dilton said, but you know, I want to hear it.
Well, a simplistic way of looking at it is that you can't define love or you can't define hate. Everything has to be rationalized. So what you see is where you have to actually get into the science of psychology, if you can even call it that. And what I was going to get into was that the video that I've had to make after that, which I was kind of reluctant to do, was in a way where the world isn't rational. That's the problem. And you see it with the way those two Nordic girls were murdered. And the Muslim, when he did that, was he has a different metaphysical existence to us, and we don't actually have one. If you're, it's just pure science and number crunching, and let's say the way they were, the government works the immigration statistics, is that it's good for the economy, and all we are is consumers and producers, therefore immigration is good. And they're missing the point, which some people are starting to cotton on to. I think Greg Johnson spoke about this, where some people are starting to cotton on to the fact that there's something beyond that as well. There's the actual ethnic feeling, and there is kinship. You're kind of ploughing over this countryside, and you're only looking at things in terms of production and consumption, and you're not looking at what it is that you're actually destroying in the process. And we don't have any kind of this sort of something beyond pure materialism has been burned away, and it's all about individualism and pure rationality and reason and everything like that. Whereas if you look at the Muslims in who did this horrible thing, they live within their own metaphysical understanding of the world, and we are going to have to form one in order to ward this horror off. And what's interesting is that on the one hand, you do just want to be in your shire, and left alone on your plot of land. But the problem is that the outside world and the realities of the world intrude on it, and you're going to have to find a way of knocking that back and keeping that in order. And when you start and talk about that, like I did on the video that I did about the two girls, people get a little bit squeamish about where this is going, and they say, "Well, you're a neocon. This is just neocon propaganda." And I'm thinking, "No, you're a retard. You don't understand that the world is a dangerous place because they're stuck. They don't understand that other people in parts of the world have different metaphysical understandings. They live in a different universe." And you're gonna have to get on board with some harsh realities. I mean, and I know that some people would say that we've been sort of saturated in this. That there's one group in particular that we are living inside of their sort of metaphysical space, and it's so all encompassing now that we can't even talk about them on the internet. But because they hold all of the choke points in the culture and in politics and especially in finance, it gets to a point where they form your reality. And so when you talk about a clearing and to get back with the snowman, I wanted to kind of explore an area where it was free of that, where it was something created by us and for us without outside elements interfering in it. Where it was just a positive European identity by and for Europeans, because most of our people don't even understand what that is.
Yeah, because I was just thinking, you know, if the snowman were to be made today, there would probably still be some love for the British countryside there in the film. You might even say British culture would be celebrated in it. But it wouldn't be ethnic, you know. The characters would be. It would be either a mixed race family or a black family, or maybe even a Muslim family. It definitely wouldn't be. Well, it's unlikely that it would be an all white family, traditionally English family.
Well, yeah, I got into that in the video. It would be easy to explore the themes in the snowman and do that. I actually say that it would be easy to imagine if, you know, the boy's parents who are roasting toast at the fire was two blokes, or the boy would be black, or the snowman would be a snow woman. And I really just wanted to keep the rubbish out for one video. I literally said that. I just wanted to keep it out for one video. The tragedy is that the next video that I made, so without thinking about it at the time, but you look back on it now, was that, yeah, at the end of the day, you're going to have the outside world crashes in, and it crashes in hard. And the reaction to that has to be, in my opinion, it has to be brutal. It has to be really brutal. But it goes to what I've been kind of exploring a lot this year, where I've learned to sort of really despise the Enlightenment liberal values more than the offshoots of the social justice movement today. The roots of it are back in the Enlightenment period for all of this trash that we have today. And when you start to sort of push against that and you start and question absolute attitudes on free speech, or whether if you've got a couple of girls, a couple of beautiful Nordic girls get murdered and held up as trophies and have raped and everything else, then is it what should the reaction actually be to that? If you're going to impose your will on the world, which you have to do, and I came to this conclusion in England with the grooming gangs.
Listen, I think you should be very, very careful what you say here.
Why?
For legal reasons.
Well, okay, this is the problem. This is what happens when you don't have power.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
And what I can't stand about Enlightenment liberalism is that it's a negation of power. It's to say power will be decided by masses of individuals, and they are all agents, and they all think rationally and individually, and the sum conclusion to all of that will be a society of freedom. And yet they have had 300 fucking years to bring this in, and here we are, hiding under fake names on the arse end of the internet, whispering about these ideas. It's been the biggest failure in all of human history. And
yeah, I know. It's a terrible situation.
You look back. You look back on the history, just say of the last couple of hundred years, and you begin to realize that at every step of the way, what we would today call classic liberalism has fucked it up, time and time again. They have gnawed away at the very fabric of Western civilization on every issue you can imagine. And now that there's a sort of populist nationalist feeling arising, they're being wheeled out again to hold the line against the SJWs, to hold us back. And one thing I do like about that, I mean, there's this resurgence in neo-reactionary thought. Have you noticed? I've noticed that on your millennial schedule this year.
It does seem to be something that people are returning to, perhaps because the more populist alt-right has sort of run out of ideas, if you like. I mean, so we're sort of returning to that idea well. But it's not wholly that, though. I think that, in general, there is a desire for reappraisal and spreading out.
Well, I think you can only get so far with memes and the JQ and race realism, and then you start to think, well, is this it? And yeah, it's the way you're going to make that step between being truly a creature of the right or just being a racist liberal. And I think a few of the sort of the big hitters kind of burned out on this, but I'm happy to see these really deep philosophical critiques becoming more prominent against the Enlightenment as a whole, and I'm really happy to see it come back.
Sorry, go on.
And at the time, I just wanted to say, like, when we go back to like 2013 or something, when before the neo-reactionary scene died away, I didn't like it very much, because my take on it then was that everybody needed to sort of do memes and red pill the normies as fast as possible. But I think there is limits to that.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, it's they seemed very stuffy, the NRX crowd.
Yeah,
I don't think they would even be annoyed at me saying that. I think they'd be quite proud of it. They seemed stuffy, a bit self-important, and a bit unfriendly, and elitist in a bad way, a bad sense of the word, from my perspective. And then the alt-right arrived and it was far more accessible and more energetic and optimistic. And but then that came up against the cold, hard reality of Hailgate and Charlottesville and various other problems. And now it needs to transform again, I would say. And part of that, or revitalize. And part of that revitalization is returning to the source of the ideas. But also, I think, I don't know, it just feels like there's more open-mindedness now. There's much less ideological shrillness than there was 6 months ago, even.
Yeah, and it makes a welcome return. And like I say, you can... I think it's fair to say, I mean, to take just one of the endless areas where classic liberalism has been a dismal failure is the idea of the free marketplace of ideas. And again, when I call this out, people immediately call me a fascist, and to us, even people in our own movement ask for me to be shut down. But the fact is, the free marketplace of ideas has been just a complete clusterfuck. It's never worked. It only works if the money power wants the ideas to work. I mean, one of the things that they say is, to get back to what I was saying before, is scientific evidence, And what is it Stefan Molyneux says? Just the facts.
Evidence. What logic, reason, and evidence, I think.
Right. This is. Well, look, we had the facts and the data on biological differences between races. We had that data decades and decades ago. It was really, like, just there. And they had to hold the line on this because this
we knew that people prefer their own. We knew about ethnocentrism before that. I don't know if that word existed then, but we knew that birds of a feather flock together. We knew that in 1946, 1947, just before the Empire Windrush came over. So it's not like this was a surprise.
It wasn't. Yeah. The evidence was in. Even back then, people knew about it. And these classic liberals, who their core value is scientific rationalism and reason and truth and free speech as well. So it all goes together in a nice little bundle. And on each and every one of them, they fucked it up. And if you take the segregation thing in America, it's fascinating because they fucked it up in the first place because it's kind of is in the American Constitution, which is based on, of course, on Enlightenment values. So it can actually reasonably be argued that it is all men because they didn't specify, because we're all individuals. So it is kind of like that. So then when it came to the desegregation movement, well, they could have at least held the line on race realism, scientific realism, scientific stats. That's their core value. Well, they fucked that up as well. They didn't hold the line one bit because they were scared, because the normies were brainwashed. The normie individual mass of the that's another one of their core values, is that everybody has agency. And yet it was just so easy for the elite to say, well, you can't judge them. There's no reason behind it. And then you get into the, so they didn't go there either. And then you get into the 1960s and desegregation happens. And then after that, like, okay, black communities in America, where all of these universities and these professors, they were all studying, they have people look at this and they say, well, black people are really kind of struggling. They're living in poverty. They're having a hard time of it. And there has to be a reason behind it. And the individualist argument isn't going to cut it because people see patterns. But at the same time, the racial side of it has, that particular pawn has been removed from the chessboard. So all it takes is leave the certain other group out of it altogether. All it takes is for some open-hearted whites to say they're oppressed.
Yeah, they're oppressed. The individualist thing obviously cannot be right. It can't be that all of these black people are just coincidentally, each one of them is coincidentally getting lower academic grades. So therefore, there has to be a pattern. Recognition going on. Some pattern has to be recognized, but then the left present a pattern, which is oppression. It's not coincidental that all of these black people are doing less well. It's happening because of the pattern of oppressing them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but the other pattern has been made, we can't talk about it because it's race.
Yeah. So that the truth has been removed from the equation. So the free market of ideas, the marketplace of ideas trope was a failure as well. The scientific realism, we're presenting evidence and facts, that was a failure. And we end up where we are now.
Yeah. This is a thing. You know, there is the famous phrase, I think it was it Ben Shapiro? Who coined? I hope it wasn't. Who coined the term? The expression, "Facts don't care about your feelings," but then Richard Spencer, he said, "Feelings don't care about your facts," and I think that's kind of sums up everything that you've been saying here. Yeah, you can have all the facts, but in the end, people are not persuaded by facts.
Yeah,
they're persuaded by their feelings, and if you can manipulate their feelings, then the facts become alien to them. Like, it's almost like the facts are written in a foreign language. They just don't get it. They're running on emotional manipulation.
I mean, how can you have a sort of an individual with agency in a mass society in the first place? It's non-stop garbage. And it all traces back. I mean, Theberton did a great video on it of Raphael Johnson talking about when you trace it back and you get back to Descartes. And Descartes said, and he's like one of the top boys of the Enlightenment. And he said, "I think, therefore I am." And what he did there, and he was hugely influential over this kind of thinking. And what he did there was to say that the only thing that you can trust in the world is your own consciousness as an individual. Well, that's it. And Hegel and a lot of the other Germans as well weren't very impressed with this at all. And they said, Hegel said, well, the problem is that Descartes was writing in Latin and he spoke in French. He thought in French. All of the people that influenced him were French and English sort of Enlightenment thinkers who were themselves influenced by an offshoot of Christian thought. And so when you begin to look at it like that, it's, and I just thought it was the most damning argument against individualism that you can possibly get, because they're not just saying, when our lads, you know, they post these memes and it's like 300 memes of one guy going up against a big army. But when you get down to it, there are no individuals in the way that the Enlightenment perceived it. It doesn't exist. It's a fraud. I mean, to bring it a little bit up to scratch, in Jordan Peterson, in what way is Jordan Peterson actually an individual in a philosophical sense?
Oh, well, he would say that he makes decisions. I'm guessing he would say that, yes, of course, I'm informed by my culture, but I make decisions that are mine to make, and I can choose to do whatever.
But he's a white man who is peddling ideas by other white men in a white society with an Enlightenment constitution. He's just an NPC. There's nothing individualist about that whatsoever. And this is the point. There isn't an individual in that way. It's a complete fraud. What you end up is with just a vacuum.
Yeah, because there it's impossible to be cultureless. It's impossible to be without something. Yeah. I mean, it's a strange thing, because I remember when I was, a dorky teenager, late teenager, I wanted to be just a person of the world, objective, rational, and without any bias, without any prejudice. And eventually you realize, well, that's impossible, because I'm already infected with a culture. I'm already contaminated. I'm already shaped by a culture. And indeed, to say, to desire to be cultureless is itself a desire promoted by late 20th century nihilistic culture.
Yeah. But it's that, to get back to the snowman, when you look at what makes something cozy and what makes something genuine and authentic, it's because all of the contingent pieces are in place, and that's to be celebrated. It's not to be swept away. It's the exact opposite way of looking at the world.
It's the only way, because that's another thing, is that if you don't have a perspective, because that's what all of this amounts to, is your culture is a perspective, it's a way of engaging with the world. And if you don't have that, you're actually just completely swamped and drowned in the sheer complexity of life. Whereas a culture allows you, it's like a lens that lets some things through, treats other things differently, and so on. So it's just a way of marshalling the chaos into something coherent and that can be handled by an individual human brain.
Yeah, and this is yet another area where they failed, because if their values were actually the lived reality of people, we wouldn't have mass immigration, we wouldn't have feminism, we wouldn't have all of the things that they complain about. We wouldn't have. We've got them because they were imposed by people with power. But then when you begin talking about in terms of power, they don't like it and they get skittish, because they prefer the individual with agency. And you just go round and round in this circle like a hamster on a wheel.
Well, I mean, this brings us to, I've just checked about this article that you wrote in defense of authoritarianism. And I was wondering if we would have talked about it last year, but we couldn't have because you only published it in May this year.
Yeah.
So, but it links with what you were just saying. And I remember sharing this on Twitter back in the in another age, because I loved this article, that the points that it makes so much. And I want to emphasize, I don't see myself as an authoritarian or a totalitarian, but I do think that there is a need for some authority in society that stands for something and preserves things. It knows what it's doing, because otherwise what happens is other powers, other authorities will just push what they want. And so, in other words, you've got to stand for something and defend it. And your society has to do that. I'm trying to look for a sort of good paragraph in this article, because the point that you were making, hold on a second. Let me see if I can find this. There was one particular paragraph, but basically you were talking about Viktor Orban in Hungary. And
Viktor Orban in Hungary specifically said that he was doing away with liberal democracy and instituting a Christian democracy. And what he did was shut down various George Soros organs within
Hungary. I've got the paragraph. I'll read this. This is really, really good stuff. As it happens, Britain today is more authoritarian now than it has ever been. Last year, 3,000 people were arrested for hate speech on the internet. The native population look over their shoulders twice before uttering the mildest politically incorrect complaint. The entirety of the society and its culture is twisted against the well-being of the native population. Such authoritarianism emanates from the Marxian left and globalism. Viktor Orban in Hungary is using authoritarianism from the right to counter it and hold it back. Now, this is the good bit. However, the position of the centrists and the individualists is that authoritarianism of any kind is evil and needs to be defeated. Let's assume that Orban adopted a centrist position in Hungary. What would happen? The various organs of the George Soros empire would instantly get to work in buying up media, political parties, and influence, as ever aided and abetted by the shills and the NGOs, loosely associated with the EU. The Hungarian people would be deluged in globalist propaganda, and the very fabric of their identity and natural social norms would come under assault. So, and then I'll read this last paragraph. Now, I'm well aware that the centrist position is to oppose the ideologies which these organs belch out, the George Soros sort of stuff. But at the same time, these centrists also support the agenda in propagating itself. They allow for the ideas to have a platform because they argue that through reason and logic, these ideas can be defeated. Except, if you don't root out and shut down the organs themselves, it will not stop, because they aren't reasonable people who are pushing this stuff.
Yeah, so that's pretty much it. And so when you make those kind of arguments, people will immediately say, well, he doesn't believe in free speech, report his blog and his Twitter account, which has literally happened to me. But they're missing the point. The point is that it depends where power lies. And if you're a centrist, you're on principle a negation of power. In that article, the flooding of Hungary with all this cultural Marxist rubbish, that's what a centrist would refer to as the free marketplace of ideas. And if it overwhelms the population in bullshit so that they just can't keep their heads above it anymore and they drown in it and become lefties, then, hey, well, you know what? That's the free marketplace of ideas. They must be right. Everybody has agency. It's garbage.
Yeah. You're just leaving things to the winds of fate, because everyone's rational, everyone's logical, it'll be okay. The best ideas will win out. But that's not the way it is. Power forces ideas. Power pushes ideas. So if you don't seize power in some way or utilize the power that you have, then your opponent's ideas, they're going to do it, and their ideas are going to win out.
Yeah, exactly. It's a funny thing. I mean, I'm switching gears slightly, but there was a Guardian article out last year called this year in May, and I put a tweet out a few days ago saying I'm thinking about doing a video of the top five worst Guardian articles of the year, and so a lot of our people jumped in and gave their suggestions. And then one of the top ones was this article called White Women Use Strategic Tears to Oppress People of Color, or something like that. And it is a fucking hideous article. And she even has a sort of red-haired, you know, Aryan Irish-looking girl, really lovely-looking white girl with a makeup smeared and stuff. And it's by she's from the Middle East somewhere, called Ruby Hamad. She's actually from Australia. And I don't know how it happened, but she replied to my tweet and said, well, if you have a criticism of my article and you make a video about it, send me the video and I'll include it in my PhD doctoral thesis or something like that. And she'd put it under the heading of something like, how the far right reacts to social justice activism or something. And so I read her article again and again, and it's just so hard to get to grips with because it's just so full of venom and hatred. And in the end of the day, it does come, it's this weird inversion of power where, like, I'm just a bloke from the Northeast. And she is the oppressed one, but she has the platform in The Guardian, and on her Twitter bio, it's this endless list of you know, she writes for newspapers in Australia and some something in the Middle East, some Arabic thing, and she's studying for a PhD, and she's this big hitter with 10,000 followers. Yet the oppressor is some bloke from the Northeast on a council estate with a fake name, and it's just ridiculous. And the bridge is that this chasm is so wide that how do you even begin to tackle those arguments? And at the end of the day, it comes down to the fact that she has institutional power and she's backed up by the establishment all of the way, but they are liars and they just won't admit it. It's a ridiculous situation.
Yeah, it is ridiculous, and but this is the thing. I think it's increasingly obviously ridiculous. I mean, I don't think there's going to be a huge change tomorrow, but I think the utter chasm, the huge chasm that exists between elite journalists and academics and ordinary people is painfully obvious at this stage. And for someone, you know, some champagne socialist to claim that she is oppressed, I mean, I'm sorry, that is just increasingly absurd.
I mean, what's ridiculous is that I'd had a 10-hour workday in a factory when I read her tweet, when she's done nothing. She sat on her arse all day drinking coffee and looking on social media, and she's getting paid to do it. She's waiting for the oppressor to come out of his factory job to give her a reply. It's fucking preposterous.
Yeah. It clearly is.
And I mean, what's funny about that article is that if you go to the URL, the Guardian, they're more satanic than people actually think, because a lot of the times they'll publish an article and then sort of shit themselves because the title is just so ridiculous, but they can't change the URL. And when you go up and have a look at the URL, in this case, it was White Women Deploy Strategic Tears to Avoid Accountability. And when you went, so basically, to avoid the payback that's coming their way. This is the mainstream British press.
Yeah. I wonder what did they change the title to?
White Women Deploy Strategic Tears to Silence Women of Color.
Right. Right.
But the original URL, which you can still see, is Avoid Accountability. But where it's this weird thing. So accountability is that basically they're going to be held to account for the sins of
you're going to be held accountable.
Yeah. There's a reckoning coming, and it's going to hurt. Well, don't you dare cry about it, or we're going to write Guardian articles about that as well.
See, that's psychological abuse. I mean, obviously, it's very muted. It's not like someone's chained up in a room and they're just being bombarded with insults and things deconstructing their identity and so on. But it's in the ether, you know. It's in the general fabric of society. White women, God knows, a lot of white women will read The Guardian, and they'll read that. They'll see that headline, and it will affect them at some level. Because that's part of why they read The Guardian in the first place. They want that weird sadomasochistic thing about being made to feel guilty, being made to hate themselves.
Yeah, and but even in within the sort of lexicon of social justice and cultural Marxism, the person that cries is the oppressed one. Under any normal circumstances, the person that cries and is upset is the one without power. And yet, when it comes to white people, white women, well, they're not allowed that. They're having an emotional breakdown is just some sort of strategic ploy to ensnare people of color into a trap.
Go on.
And that's why I had a hard time with it, because you're so far removed of people that all you can say, I can't say it because I don't have freedom of speech, but I would say that this behavior is sort of similar to the way a parasite digs in on a host and just sort of embeds itself and drips poison into its system.
Mm, mm. One thing that this also links with is a video you made recently, because you're talking about the original title of that article was they're trying to avoid accountability. Well, that reminds me of the video you made about 3 weeks ago, you're trying to avoid the consequences of your hate speech, and you deserve this. And you mentioned, you take it away.
Well, yeah, it was the Sargon, let's call it the Patreon crisis. Well, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I don't really get involved in all this stuff very much. But yeah, I understand it. I understand what's going on with it all. It is a big deal. But I was just having a look at the way the lefties reacted to it. And it was basically that whenever we, or in this case, Sargon of Akkad and the centrists, you know, I mean, I think I've made it plain that I don't really like their way of looking at the world. But on a personal level, I don't really have much animosity towards them. But they're even when they are banned, the it's like raising the bar. So it's your fault. If you can't jump that hurdle, then it's your fault.
You're right. You were talking about that feminine. We don't need to name her. But I mean, I don't want to get personal harassment charge here. But there was a particular feminist who made a video gloating about what had happened to Sargon of Akkad. And there were many people on social media repeating what she'd said, or just saying it in their own way, which is basically, well, you say hateful stuff, you go against the program, you are counter-progressive. And what did you expect to happen? You deserve this. You deserve to lose your livelihood.
Yeah, it's your fault. It's your fault. It's your fault when the police kick your door down and arrest you for hate speech. Where does it end? Because the vast majority of people who are arrested for hate speech in Britain are like normie working class whites who post anti-Muslim memes on Facebook. And I never bother with Facebook, but they do it. But they do it because they think that they've still got free speech. And they all of a sudden the police kick their door down and drag them off. People like us in our circles, you know, mainly on Twitter and the sort of the alt-right type scene, they're more aware of what they can and can't get away with. And few of us actually do get arrested. But the normie sort of work, council estate working class whites are being arrested in the thousands because they don't understand. They think they're still living in a country with free speech and they can do whatever they want, and they can't. And the reaction of the social justice warriors to that would be, well, they should have known. It's their fault. They should have known when they're being having the doors kicked down in the middle of the night because they posted something about a mosque going up in Bradford or whatever, then they should have educated themselves and they should have known what the program was. Your fault.
It really is scary because, as you say, what's the limit?
Yeah.
How far are you going to take that notion that you bring these consequences upon yourself? It basically absolves, well, in this case, the left of, they can just give them carte blanche.
Yeah. In that video that I did, I drew it to its logical conclusion, which was Winston being tortured in 1984. I made a kind of meme for it and used it in the video. And you've got O'Brien torturing Winston explaining to Winston that this is your fault. We're pulling your teeth out and sticking rats in a cage on your face, but you did this to yourself. You did this to yourself by breaking the rules. The idea that
you're forcing us to do this to you. I mean, it's the cliche. It's the cliche of the bully at school who says, look, you're doing this to yourself. I'm not bullying you. You're bringing this upon yourself.
Yeah.
It's bloody hell.
It's horrific. So whatever the consequences are, it doesn't matter. If you brought this on yourself, then that's your fault. The idea of that somebody is setting the running and somebody has an agenda. You see, that's what this particular woman also said, was that this is just free market capitalism. This is the system. If you don't like it, leave it.
It's so disgusting. The smugness with which they say this stuff, because then they go, well, if you don't like it, just create your own funding platform, your own video sharing website. And what have we seen? We've seen funding platforms, Maker Support, Patreon, and now Subscribestar sabotaged by the Silicon Valley. Video sharing websites. I mean, BitChute has been banned from PayPal, Patreon, probably, I think, Stripe as well, actually. So you can't do that either. So this idea that you can just create your own, I mean, how far do we have to take that in order to hit these fucking bastards?
You have to create your own central bank and government.
Yeah.
But if you try to do that, you'll be done for treason. They'll bring back some old antiquated law which they hated in the past, which was treason against the nation state and its people. And they'll suddenly remember, you can't do that. So if I was to sort of institute make the capital city of Northumberland, Berwick or Morpeth, and then sort of say, well, now this is my government and I'm the emperor, and I'm gonna have my own internet provider and central bank. Well, it would be a national bank. The government would come after us for that as well.
It is a scary thing because you realise, well, this is the point of being in charge of different corporations, of having different lobby groups set up, of being in with the government here and there, and dominating academia, getting your ideas everywhere. You can basically just control society at that point.
Yeah. And it gets back to what I was saying before about the free marketplace of ideas. So where does this fit into the free market? The free marketplace of ideas is completely rigged. It always was. It was always rigged by those with power. And I don't know how you get around it, unless you gather enough power in your own ranks and then assert it. That's all you can do. And you end up in this sort of Nietzschean will to power escalation.
I think that is going to happen. I think that there will be people who realize that, they're going to conclude Silicon Valley isn't listening to us. Even the EU isn't listening to us. Various powers aren't listening to us. So we have to gather our own power in order to be able to have some, what's the word? Leverage. That's the word I'm looking for. I think that will happen because it's the cliche. If you don't listen to people's complaints, then eventually they're going to take action without your say so, without your permission.
I mean, one of the things, and I know this is controversial, but not in a censorship way, but just in terms of populist politics, one way you could do, and which a lot of people on the reactionary right, the dissident right, have been talking about a long time, is trying for a way to sort of destroy the system itself, and it does come down to the money power. And what one idea that I've been playing around with recently, there's a scene in The Two Towers, just to sort of paint it out a little bit, because I always try and impress the lads at the blog with getting Lord of the Rings references into everything. There's a scene in The Two Towers when there's one of the Uruk-hai, and what they've done is it's the siege of Helm's Deep. And the orcish army, have buried a sort of primitive bomb in the wall. And then there's this moment when the Uruk-hai is holding a torch up and he runs towards the bomb. And then Aragorn spots what he's up to and he starts screaming at everybody, take him down, take him down, take him down. Now, because he knows the consequences of them blowing the wall up and breaching the fort. And what I would like to see is that you could have a sort of populist nationalist party running in on a populist ticket, and then, let's say, in Italy, it would have to be a big country, and then once they get in power, blowing up the central banks and fucking them off from within. It fascinated me with the Salvini thing, when they took over Italy, that it's everybody thinks of Salvini and the migration thing in the Mediterranean. But what people have forgotten is that the Italian Minister of Finance, that was on the minds of the elite at that moment when Italy was turning populist, was not actually the migrants. All of the humanitarian values, they went out the fucking window. What they cared about was who had the hands on the finances, because Italy's $2 trillion in debt. And the president of Italy had to, they couldn't do anything. They had to parachute in some bureaucrat from the EU to get his hands on the central banks. And it was this sort of, we don't care about the Africans. Get your hands on the banks. Get your hand on the finances of Italy quickly. Fuck the Africans. And the reason for that is because if they did have complete control, they could have said, we're going to bring back the lira, fuck the debt and fuck the central banks, and basically that will be it, and that would be like a sort of domino effect. And that's when if you look at sort of prominent nationalist movements in the past who shall remain nameless, they were obsessed with the money power. They understood where the true power was, and when you go after that, When you say we aren't going to pay the interest anymore, we aren't going to pay the money anymore, then you'll see the bastards squeal, really squeal. And I'd like to see that happen because it wouldn't have to be explicitly racial or really hardcore or anything like that. Get into power and tell the banks to go fuck themselves.
But well, that's like Iceland did, apparently.
Yeah, but
that was, I've forgotten what the details of that were. But anyway,
yeah, and that's like, that's like a city the size of Cardiff or something, if you look at all the people in it. But if you're looking at a major country like Italy or Spain or France or something, then you would really see them squeal. But that's when the mask comes off, and we saw it with Germany in the 1930s. They will really just pull out all the stops because they're not stupid. And they've had these plans going for a long
time. I mean, look at this recent Yellow Jackets thing in France. There's a girl, there's a young French woman who is going to be missing an eye for the rest of her life because of Emmanuel Macron, because whatever the yellow vest thing, yellow jacket thing, the gilets jaunes, whatever it represents, we don't know whether it's left wing or right wing. We don't know. But it is anti-globalism. That seems to be fairly consistent. And so Emmanuel Macron is obviously a representative of that. And that's the end of it. Yeah, so now this girl got shot with something. I don't know if it was a rubber bullet or if it was some kind of grenade. She's going to be missing an eye for the rest of it. I mean, there's something really horrendous about that. And I don't mean to... I'm using that as a sort of example because it illustrates that they are ruthless.
Well, the elites and the police and things, they take a step back and they think if it's just a bunch of lefty wankers and they're going on about peace and love, then okay, let it go. And if it's a right-wing movement against immigration, they're a little bit more uncomfortable. If it's a sort of an embryonic mass populist movement and they're saying we want out of this sort of central banking system and we want to print our own money and we want rid of the debt and we want to have a decent quality of life, then you'll see the fangs come out. And it looks like, I haven't followed it very closely with the yellow vests. I haven't had time.
Well,
but it looks they don't like it anymore.
People in the chat are saying that some guy in Bordeaux lost his hand and someone else is saying someone lost an arm. I did hear about that just once. I didn't see any pictures or anything. It hasn't stayed in my memory. I don't know if they're talking about the same person or whatever. But I just bring that up. I know some would say it's sort of trivial. It's only one injury. It's only one person or whatever. But the point is, I think it why is that woman now going to have this disability? And probably struggle to, I mean, she won't be as attractive and so on. This guy, let's say one of them's lost a hand. Why is he going to be without a hand for the rest of his fucking life? Because whatever the Yellow Jackets thing represents, it is perceived by the power structure as a threat. And so they did this to people.
Yeah, if you go after the money, you're more of a threat than if you go after the race. The sort of blood and soil things. It's when you combine the two that it's dynamite. And so nationalists have to understand that even if they're not out there with placards saying end immigration, it is embryonic because it follows on logically that they want their own country. And it's our job to make it plain that mass immigration is, and the left as a whole, is just a tool of the elites, and that as nationalists, we belong on the ground with the people.
Well, yeah, indeed. Absolutely. And I think that is going to become increasingly apparent. I mean, something that you've talked about, you and I have talked about several. I mean, I should say, actually, that Morgoth and I did a hangout on my live channel. So, you know, maybe consider subscribing to that. We did a nice one about the Tommy Robinson. In fact, it was actually titled The Tommy Robinson Thing when he was arrested and imprisoned back in May. I think it was May. And it's a really good, nice, concise hangout, as I recall. I was very pleased with it. And part of this is that what we saw around that time, I can't remember the chronology now, but there were guys climbing the gates of Downing Street. And you know, you can say what you like about Tommy Robinson, but I think that, Morgoth, you agree with me that there is, there is currency, so to speak, in having a guy like that around, because he does animate people's passions. And, I do believe that the establishment are scared of him.
Yeah, but the problem that you've got is that it's not 2005 anymore, and everybody is looking. I mean, The Guardian had an article up a few weeks ago when it was like the people who are funding Tommy Robinson, and it was like David Horowitz and all these foundations and lobby groups and things.
Yeah, neocons and stuff.
Yes, and then that's the problem that we've got with him. And if he was going to be straightforward, boots on the ground, all for the English working class. And if he did, look, he doesn't have to go into anything dodgy. I understand that. He doesn't have to get into race realism. If he just wants to be a campaigner against the grooming gangs and then get crowdfunding from the British working class, that's fair enough. But hey, come on, eh? I'm not a fucking moron. I know where that money's coming from, and I know why those Israeli flags are flying at that Brexit meeting a couple of weeks ago. And that shit has to stop. It's not 2007 anymore. We know.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, the reason I brought this up was that it was there was a sense of power, and you know, the British state did respond to it.
Yes, yeah, that's a different thing. There is momentum behind a populist movement. But, I mean, the problem is, do you want it related to these think tanks and lobby groups in America? And I don't.
No, I agree. Of course I agree. I don't. But yeah, that's not the point that I'm making.
Tommy Robinson has to understand how this looks.
Yeah.
It's enough. I've had enough of this.
Yeah, I know. But at the moment, it is a sort of building of momentum, of energy. I mean, definitely, you know, you might say it's not enough, whatever. But for the establishment, the globalists, the Antifa and so on, this thing is very frightening.
Well, I mean, the broadly speaking, there is an anti-PC backlash, and that's a good thing. That's a really good thing. And the reason why I sort of hammered on about classic liberalism tonight is because I know that certain parties have already taken stock, and they're looking at this in sort of strategic terms, like a chessboard. And they're thinking, well, let's get them into classic liberalism. Let's sort of funnel them down into the blind alley of individualism. And, you know, for the smarter ones, they've got Quillette, which sounds like a gay hairdresser's, this Quillette website. And what they do, I mean, I should say, and you've got book after book after book coming out by Steven Pinker and Jonathan Haidt and all of these sort of, they're peddling this globalist individualist mantra. And I have to say, there's been some great articles of Countercurrents sort of dissecting these articles and stuff. So they do know, and they know the populist movement isn't going to fall for lefty sort of Owen Jones, SJW bullshit, but they might fall for individualism and freedom of speech. And so let's back Quillette all of the way, and let's back Steven Pinker's new book, and let's call it the dark web and make it something mysterious and alluring. And I just think, you know what it is? Fuck off. Because all of your principles are bullshit, and I just explained why before. I cannot be doing with it. And I think the movement needs to get beyond that and into something else. And that's why I'm really happy. I think the battle is going to be, I mean, and I know you can talk about like these strategic alliances of deplatforming, and we've got to have these free speech laws on the internet and everything. But at the end of the day, we do want our ideas to prevail over theirs within the dissident right. And it's really important that these clever lads who are in the neo-reactionary type thing get to work with these serious criticisms of the Enlightenment, and that their ideas are replaced with ours. Because there's no point in all of this if we're going to end up back in a sort of Christopher Hitchens tier 2009. That's no good at all.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, shall we, before we end, shall we have a look through the super chats? And because I know that people have been posting them. Let's see how many people. We've got 933 viewers right now, which is quite cool. All right, quite a lot of questions. Okay, someone says, thank you for your content, brother. Glad you're back. I don't know if he's addressing me there. Someone says, Tarkadal says, you and Morgoth should do more videos together. Two great channels and two great speakers. And then somebody else, Vigilante Jesus, says, the BBC reported that those girls, this is in Morocco, sustained injuries to the neck. which of course is a dreadful euphemism for what was actually done to them. And then someone else says, here's to fallen comrade Dan O'Connor. Now,
oh, Dan O'Connor, remember him?
Yeah, he was from the Telegraph blogs. He was on there, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I don't know who that is, but I don't. As far as I know, nobody had any kind of contact with him. I certainly didn't.
No.
I don't know what he means by that, but
I made it
fun. Dan O'Connor was great. Dan O'Connor was the one who pointed out that conservatives were always using a shield and baton and the left were using a sword.
That's a good one. Indeed, they are. I mean, this is it. They never go on the attack, but then they just attack you, and gradually they wear down your defences. All right, so I this person must be a friend of Dan O'Connor, and I do remember the name because he was very prolific on the Daily Telegraph blogs.
Wonderful man. If he's passed away, I don't know. I haven't had any contact with him for years, but he was a great bloke. I'm really sad if he's passed away, but that's all I've got to go off is what you're saying. Yeah, super chat.
Yeah, yeah. Let me see from the live chats if he's. I can't see him explaining, so I don't know. Okay, we'll move on. Right, and then someone says. Yes, okay. Nationalism and socialism is a forbidden synthesis because it is diametrically opposed to the neoliberal order, hence the callous use of force.
Yep.
Yep, I think we can agree on that. Then someone says, Vigilante Jesus says, if you love your nation, you're a nationalist. Okay. If you love your people, you're a socialist. I don't think that's necessarily the truth, to be honest. But anyway, and then he goes, so pray tell, what on earth is wrong with National Socialism? Okay, indeed. I understand.
He's a regular at me blog and the blog comments community.
All right. And then Sussex Damsel says, Morgoth is one of the best thinkers of our time. Subscribe to his channel. Thank you, Woz. Merry Christmas, everyone. God bless you all. So thank you very much.
I'm just a bloke with a blog. I'm just a bloke with a blog. I've never claimed to be anything else.
All right. And John Smith says Merry Christmas. So thank you for that.
All right. Merry Christmas, ladies and gentlemen.
All right. So do you want to end it there?
Yeah, I am. That's good enough for me.
Okay. I think we went for about an hour and 10 minutes. I'm not sure. All right. Okay. So, well, Morgoth, thank you for appearing again on my channel. I always look forward to our conversations.
All right. It's been nice.
All right. So,
see you later, everybody.
Okay. So, that's Morgoth on Millennial 2018. Thank you. And I will be back in about half an hour with the final guest, the live guest. It'll be live. the final live broadcast. And then tomorrow there'll be four pre-records. The final one is Lucy Brown. So, I'll be back in half an hour with her. And okay, hope you enjoyed Morgoth. See you later.